Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
This week's broadcast of Nature Now was originally produced in the spring of 2019.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the second week of May. This week, we are very pleased to have Dr. Jeff Hammerson as our guest. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you.
Jeff is a very gifted biologist and naturalist and could speak with us on any number of fascinating topics. But he has been especially focused on bird migration for the last couple of years. So that is what we are going to talk about today, especially as it is such a perfect topic for this time of year. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this an amazing sound? We've really made you scratch your heads for this one. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. Those of you who are faithful listeners of our program will likely recognize Jeff's name as the fellow who often sends us the wonderful photo essays to share with you. In fact, Jeff, you sent me an amazing close-up photo of a bald-faced hornet just yesterday. And man, that fierce countenance it has. Wouldn't you hate to be like the size of a fly and encounter something like that?
No, I wouldn't.
So what was the story with that?
No, I was cutting up some logs that had been stored over the winter, crawling around nearby. I think I disturbed this bald-faced hornet. Had been hibernating in probably that log pile.
Because they're like yellow jackets, right? In that the female will tuck herself away for
the queens.
Winter time.
So This is a very large individual, clearly a queen, and was still kind of out of it, but crawling around.
You were glad. Kind of disoriented. You were glad she was out
yes.
of it.
Yeah, because it was amazing as I was taking these close-up photos. Every time I got close to her, she kind of went on alert and looked startled a little bit. So she was seeing what was going on, but still kind of drowsy, I think, and not fully prepared to defend herself. And so it was very innocuous encounter. But yeah. She'd probably been hibernating, and probably this coming week, as the weather warms up, she'll start feeding and starting her nest.
And they are fierce, but they're really great scavengers. I mean, they're very important.
They're predators. They eat a lot of other insects and things that we don't like. We don't like hornets, most of us, but they do play their role in eating other forms of insects that we also don't maybe like to have, little caterpillars and flies and so forth.
Yeah, they're good ones. It's such a great time of year because every day something new is coming. I mean, new birds, and just this past week, it seems like all the warblers arrived. Have you hearing and seeing
orange
a bunch of warblers?
Orange-crowned warblers, Townsend's warbler, black-throated gray warbler.
I had a really wonderful view of a black-throated gray. You know, that you can usually tell them by the sound because they're so skulky. They're usually tucked away. But I had a beautiful view of one last week. They're nice. That really smart black and white and that bright little dot of yellow, the male, right by the edge of the eye.
Yeah, yeah. And Wilson's warbler and the Pacific Slope flycatcher. This past week has just been a huge migration of songbirds through our area in the forests.
Well, migrants and then ones that are going to stay and breed with us this
summer.
Some
are staying and already setting up territories. Others will just pass on up to British Columbia and Alaska.
Yeah. And also, I wanted to put out a reminder that the prairie is at its peak, the Kaitai Prairie. And just to make clear that the Kaitai Prairie is different from the Kaitai Nature Park and Lagoon, that the prairie is actually right across from the station, right at the edge of the Port Townsend Golf Course. And it's just a sea of blue common camas and the bright yellow lomatium. Mm-hmm. So it's really it's really looking lovely.
Beautiful place to visit.
Yes, it is. And the rhododendrons are starting to bloom too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've had this progression of pink flowers. The salmonberry started out really a long time ago, months ago, and they're still flowering, and the red flowering currant. And now the Pacific rhododendrons are opening up their flowers, and the bumblebees and the rufous hummingbirds have been taking advantage of those.
So that brings us to the topic of migration, which is our topic for this week. Perhaps we should start with asking you to define what biologists mean when they talk about migration, Jeff.
Yeah, that's a good way to start because the word migration and migrants have been in the news a lot lately with respect to people.
Yeah.
And that's a different sort of migration. In the case of people, it's mostly people moving from one place to another and intending to settle there and not necessarily return. But for bird migration, we mean a round-trip movement between two areas, and specifically a seasonal movement between a nesting or breeding area and another place that's used only in winter or for non-breeding purposes. So it's a round-trip movement back and forth seasonally when we're talking about bird migration.
And when we talk about bird migration, we generally think about the epic journeys of like vast flocks of birds flying thousands of miles. But there are actually various different types of migration, right?
Yeah, we have the whole gamut here, right around here in Port Townsend, from things like Pacific wrens and spotted towhees and song sparrows and chickadees that pretty much don't move at all throughout the year, stay put. Their homebodies, you know, they don't go very far, most of them. Part of the population might go somewhere else, just depending on how much food's around. Some of them might decide to head south. American robins probably just move around to wherever there's a good fruit supply, you know, small fleshy fruits that they eat a lot of during the winter. So they might not have to go very far. Yellow-rumped warblers, Townsend's warblers, sometimes you can see them here in the winter. But most of the population migrates.
And that's something that a lot of people don't realize is that they see these birds and they think it's the same birds that have stayed. But some truly are resident, and then sometimes we'll be seeing migrants that are just passing through, but they look the same, unless you're lucky enough to see bands on them.
Yeah, it could be really actually confusing to understand what you're seeing because, as you said, is this robin from a local nest, or did this come down from Alaska or British Columbia? That Cooper's hawk or red-tailed hawk that you saw in December, January, did that nest here locally, or again, did that come from somewhere else? So it can be really hard to figure out without known individuals or tracked individuals with devices on them that tell us where they're going. A lot of the birds that are migrants around here that pretty much all disappear, black-headed grosbeaks, for example, they all go to Mexico, and then they come back. Swainson's thrushes, beautiful singing birds that are here, arriving just now, and will be here through the summer. The ones that nest around here end up in southern Mexico or Central America. If you go to the east side of the Cascades, those go all the way to South America.
Wow.
So all kinds of different patterns just around in our local forests and shores.
And some of them just move up and down in elevation, right? I mean,
right.
Like the varied thrush, we see them all winter down here at lower elevations. We're like, well, where are those varied thrush? And they're actually just up in the mountains to breed.
Yeah, a lot of those might right now be that we saw here in the winter throwing leaves around on the ground, looking for their hidden objects, might be up in the Olympics right now, staking out nesting territory. So they just move up and down the mountain slopes. American dippers do that too, along streams. Move down the stream for the winter, and then as things melt out in the mountains, they go up farther upstream.
Oh, that's cool. That makes perfect sense. So what drives a species to choose a strategy of migrating rather than remaining resident in an area?
Well, that can get to be a complicated answer if you look at all the little nuances of the life history of birds. But one of the main drivers is, what do you eat and how available is it? So if you're a swift or a swallow or a flycatcher and you pretty much depend on flying insects to be in the air for your diet, well, in the winter, there's not much of that available here, so they have to go somewhere else and somewhere warmer to the south. And so that's an important thing. For other birds, it might be other sorts of foods that are only seasonally available. If you're going to stick around, you better be pretty much of an opportunist, like a crow.
Or an omnivore, where you can do insects sometimes and fruits other times.
Yeah,
and
very flexible.
Yep.
And then, or you might be a specialist at finding seeds that are in the soil, because there are a lot of seeds in the soil at the end of the fall. And sparrows, towhees, and so forth, they can find those. They scratch in the soil, and they can feed themselves quite well through the winter. Or let's say you're a woodpecker or a chickadee. Those are really good at finding tiny little hidden sources of food that aren't available.
Like little spiders and little spider eggs that are tucked into crevices.
Or behind bark. You know, woodpecker pecking bark off and exposing little beetles and other insects that they can feed themselves with. So they're able to get through the winter without much problem. Or if you're a hawk or an owl and you eat other birds or mammals that are active throughout the winter, that's another way of being able to stick around here and not have to go somewhere else.
And then there are species that practice eruptive migratory behavior, right? Like the snowy owls are a classic example where, like, every 7 years we get some down here and you're like, why do we see them now? And they're kind of on a cycle, a lot of them, right?
Yeah, snowy owls are interesting in that how many young they produce is a result of how much food they have. When there's a lot of lemmings up in the Arctic where they nest and they're well fed, they'll raise maybe 7 or 8 babies that year and feed them all. If it's a poor year, they might only be successful at raising 1 or 2 of their offspring. But when we get these big lemming populations and the owls are nesting successfully, there are so many young owls produced, and then they all have to get through the winter. But there's, you know, only a limit to how long that lemming abundance lasts. And so those are the years, big population growth years, when you see a lot of snowy owls come south.
And it's usually then the young birds. I mean, the young at that point look exactly like the adults, so we can't really tell the differences, but it's mostly the young birds that end up coming south. And the residents already have their territory staked out, and they remain on site.
Right, exactly, yeah. So a lot of those young birds are just spread out, trying to find things to eat, and everything just falls into place in certain years, every several, as you mentioned, and boom, you get a whole bunch of these Arctic owls appearing in odd places.
And there are other species that do it too, right? Like the crossbills, birds that are tuned in to seed crops.
Yeah, in the boreal forests of Alaska and Canada, there are a large number of birds that subsist on tree seeds. It might be crossbills and pine siskins, evening grosbeaks, red-breasted nuthatches, redpolls, all kinds of seed-eating birds. And again, if they face a year with not too many seeds available, they'll just head south. And again, at several-year intervals, they'll show up in big numbers down here, where we might see in a normal year only a few of those, if any, maybe none. In other years, like everywhere you look, wow, there they are. And it's very remarkable, and the birding community gets all excited because it's a chance to see species, some of the species anyway, that you wouldn't normally get to see, like redpolls in some places, evening grosbeaks, not just for everyday observation around here.
Yeah.
So it's special.
It is. So our North American birds have several clearly defined flyways, right? Would you tell me a little bit about that?
So you've probably heard that we live here in the Pacific Flyway, and there are other flyways across North America, the Central Flyway, the Mississippi Flyway, the Atlantic Flyway. And these are just kind of regions, north-south extending regions that were used as a framework for waterfowl conservation. It's how it got started. Was pretty much people noticed ducks fly north and south seasonally. You know, they go north to nest and they go south to winter. And they sort of do that across the continent along these regions, the Pacific Coast or the Atlantic Coast or maybe the Mississippi River or the Great Plains regions. But today we kind of expand our world beyond North America, and waterfowl, ducks especially, but also geese and swans.
Well, our knowledge has really been expanded too, right, with a lot more banding and with geotagging birds to know where they go.
Yeah, and it's actually shown us that the pathways that we saw for the ducks that go north and south, which gave us really good framework for making sure we protected the populations in their wintering areas and their nesting areas, turned out to be, when you look at shorebirds, for example, whoa, those pathways are only used for part of the year sometimes. In fact, many of the birds in the Pacific Flyway are only in the flyway for a very small part of the year. If we look at shorebirds especially, some of them, like for example, whimbrels, it's a shorebird, kind of large sandpipery kind of bird with a long downcurved bill. They nest up in Alaska and other places too, but the ones that nest in Alaska and Arctic Western Canada, which are in the Pacific Flyway, actually spend the winter on the Atlantic coast of Brazil, some of them.
Wow, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and then they fly across North America to get there. They fly over the ocean to reach Brazil. Then they fly across the Caribbean and Mexico to get to the West Coast. And then some of the ones you can see right now here around Port Townsend may have come from Brazil and are heading up the coast toward Alaska and maybe Arctic Canada to nest. And then they'll do that big loop again. So many other birds besides waterfowl use the Pacific Flyway, this area, but they're not confined to it. It's not a interstate highway with no exits or on-ramps.
Uh-huh. They do lots of little side trips. And the other thing that's really amazing to me is that they go one way north. They don't necessarily take the same way back south, right?
No, because there's a couple factors involved in that. One, it could be that food is more available in one area going southward, let's say in the late summer and fall. And then in the spring, maybe that area is not so great to feed, but some other place might be more prolific in food supply. So that's one of the things, is food availability along the different routes at different seasons. But also winds. These birds make use of wind a lot to ease their flights. And so going south, it may be more advantageous to go one way where you have tailwinds, but in the spring there might not be tailwinds going in that direction by that route. They're flexible enough to find another way that gives them tailwinds going north. So you can end up with these odd patterns.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense when you think about it. You were describing to me, like rufous hummingbirds, how they go north and then they swing south through the Rockies so that they could take advantage of all the amazing flowering alpine vegetation on their way south, right?
Yeah, there's a big bloom on the Pacific coast in the spring that sweeps northward and fuels their journey northward up to BC and Alaska. But in the late summer, it's the Rocky Mountains that have the big bloom of wildflowers. And so they come back along that route and take advantage of all that nectar that's available.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's an amazing world out there. Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time for today. We knew we would do this, but luckily we'll have part two next month. So thank you so much. And we'll look forward to hearing part two of this amazing discussion.
Thank you.
Month.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And here's our mystery sound again. most of you will have an easier time identifying the following call. And Jeff will tell you a little bit about it.
Yeah, this was a trick
question. It was a trick, but isn't it so beautiful? It's just an amazing fluty call.
Yes, and so what you've been hearing, the mystery sound, some of you may have recognized it in its normal speed pattern as very, very much sounding like a Pacific wren, which is a tiny little songbird that lives year-round in the forests
that we all love,
here.
That used to be called the winter wren here, but yeah, they've split them now into two separate species.
Yeah, right? So the ones in the west, now they're called Pacific wrens, and ones in the east are winter wrens still. Pacific wren sounds like a seabird to me, so I don't like that name, but
I know,
we're kind of stuck with it.
I prefer winter wren.
A fellow who is a songbird specialist, a bird song specialist, I should say, Donald Kruidsma, these are his recordings. And he recorded these from an eastern population, but it pretty much sounds just like our local Pacific wrens that live here in Port Townsend. Our auditory system and our brain can't process the rapidity of those sounds in a meaningful way, really, other than just as, wow, that is just incredibly fast and complicated and quite a mouthful. When you watch these birds sing, it's quite impressive. But slowed down, you see there's so many you don't see, you hear. You can actually see it if you do a what's called a sonograph. You can plot it out on paper. Uh-huh. Anyway, if you listen to those the slowed down version, you just realize how many little nuances and different sounds there are that make that up. And the birds process that information. In fact, they can copy it just to make
and that,
it a
lot. And that was part of his study, right, is to see whether young birds could learn the calls from their new neighbors.
By plotting this out and slowing it all down, you can look note for note. And what he discovered, the researcher Kruidsma and other colleagues, was that a young bird settling down in a neighborhood for its first breeding season listens to the males that are there and starts copying them. And they can copy note for note all those sounds that we can't even figure one from another. It just sounds like a buzzy blur.
Wow.
They can mimic the other individuals and come to sound very much like them. And it's a pattern that's evident in other kinds of birds as well. Song sparrows do the same thing.
Well, how cool. Well, that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the second week of May. And thank you so much for joining me, Jeff. And thanks to all of you for listening. Our sound editor and engineer today is Nora Petrich, and our closing music is Beating Drums from the marvelous film Winged Migration. As always, happy trails.